Well, I want to thank Randy for inviting me to this symposium. I realized I had not been to a Soil Science Society of America meeting in 5 years. So this was a really great motivation for me to come. And one of the things I've been doing is working a lot on soil-plant relations and working with ecologists. I've also been doing some reading. In fact, I felt really, really guilty in my hotel room this morning, taking a shower in that nice hotel room. Has anyone read the novel The Water Knife by Paolo Bacigalupi? If you have not, I really recommend it after your stay here in Phoenix. The work I've been doing has a lot of management implications. Here we are in the western U.S. in an area that is largely dry and is predicted to become warmer and drier with climate change. So that's going to be the perspective I'll take. I want to start on the grand view. So here's our globe, North America, the western part of North America, particularly in the southwestern United States, is really striking with the relief, the patterns, and the colors. Zooming in a little bit more, we see what Craig was talking about with the basin and range, physiographic region, and then the Colorado Plateau through here. Putting the state lines and a few geographic indicators on here, the area we'll be talking about will be in Utah, in the western part of Utah, in the Great Basin, southern part of the Great Basin, into the Mojave Desert near Las Vegas. We're going to circle through down to Las Cruces, New Mexico area in the Chihuahuan Desert, and then come back to the Colorado Plateau. Okay, just reviewing what was driving the evolution of North America, the spreading along the mid-Atlantic ridge causing compression in the western part of North America. This predated the evolution of the basin and range. This compression in the Colorado Plateau region caused that thick crystalline continental crust to fracture and then be thrust in creating these thrust faults. And the Colorado Plateau, which was a basin for 250 or more million years collecting sediments, those sediments are soft and they basically are like a blanket and they roll and fold over these underlying faults. In contrast, the western and southern parts of the continent to the Colorado Plateau, the rock is very thin, and so when there was regional compression, those layered thin rocks fractured and were thrust over in this kind of pattern. Regional thrust faulting we see all throughout the western part of Utah and in Nevada. When the subduction of the Farallon Plate was completed and the western edge of the North American continent became in contact with the Pacific Plate, that fault, we then had the extension of the western part of North America. The Colorado Plateau, because of the unloading of the crust, was uplifted and continues to be uplifted today. There were laccolithic intrusions, so mantle upwellings coming up through the rock, creating these high elevation mountains on the landscape. In contrast, the basin and range, spreading, faults developing, the Horst and Graben basin and range formation. And it's a little bit more complicated than that. A lot of these valleys were these land blocks that were sliding along detachment faults. It's really a combination of those two kinds of processes, giving us the basins and the range, the basins over episodes of climate change, filling with alluvium. In the Great Basin part of the basin and range, many of those basins are closed drainages. Lakes were forming, particularly notable during the latter part of the Pleistocene, and then depositing lake or lacustrine sediments. Okay, in this context, we have are factors of soil formation, a great conceptual model. It was originally written such that soils are a function of P-crot, as I like to call it. But really, these factors co-vary with the soil, and there are feedbacks. We particularly see this in respect to the plant community. This is the Arches National Park, the Colorado Plateau in the foreground. And in the distance, we have the LaSalle Mountains, the Laccolithic intrusions. High elevation areas, the highest elevations have vegetation of aspen forest, especially in the wetter areas. Aspen forest, the quality of the vegetation in terms of litter, it's very decomposable, and forests are typically open canopy forests with a lot of understory vegetation, resulting in an imprinting, an influence of the organisms on the soil. Most of the soils under aspen in these regions, especially up in the northern Great Basin and the Colorado Plateau, are mollisols. In contrast, conifer forests, closed canopy, very different soils, thin O horizon, thin A horizon, and then the formation of E horizons. We see this in many places, classic imprinting of the soil over the landscape. Moving to drier areas, most of the Great Basin, the southern Great Basin, into the Basin and Range Colorado Plateau are arid regions. So looking in south and western Utah, classic Great Basin landscapes. So Basin and Range, but these drainages are closed drainages. Typically we see these broad alluvial fans dominated by gravelly alluvium. The soils are usually quite deep, and sagebrush, Artemisia tridentata, is the dominant plant in this community. In the hill slopes, or the hill slopes of the ranges, we have typically more shallow soil, and in the Great Basin, especially the western part of Utah into Nevada, they're dominated by juniper, Juniperus osteosperma. On the alluvial fans, we see a change often in the dominant shrub based on the mineralogy. So here we are in the San Francisco Mountains of western Utah, and it's a mixture of rocks, sedimentary rocks, quartzite, sandstone, limestone, mixed with igneous intrusions. So along that margin between the Basin and Range and the Colorado Plateau, the crust is thin. There are quite a few of these igneous intrusions. So the basin is a mixture of sediments derived. Looking at Landsat imagery, Landsat imagery, these alluvial fans, using a principal components analysis of the Landsat imagery, we can distinguish the influence of different parent materials. Mainly here, you can see the influence of an andesitic intrusion into what's dominantly quartzite of the San Francisco Mountains, the influence of that on the alluvial fan. The vegetation communities will change. To the north of this area, the alluvial fans are dominated by sagebrush. In the area where there are the andesitic sediments influencing the fan, we see a lot of atroplex confertifolia. pHs are generally higher, carbonate content lower, and therefore the dominant shrub changing in these two different communities. Further west in the Great Basin, in an area that is right along the Nevada-Utah border near Great Basin National Park, an area that is threatened by development of water by the Southern Nevada Water Authority. There are plans to put deep groundwater pumps throughout northern Nevada to divert water down to Las Vegas. And so we did a bit of work here in Snake Valley along the border. What we were concerned about is, what is the vegetation, what are the soils like, and what might be the impact of large-scale groundwater pumping in this region. The alluvial sands that are gravelly, dominated by sagebrush, give way to these lake plains where the dominant shrub is greasewood, Sarcobatus vermiculatus, and there are saline seeps throughout this area. Very commonly, the salts, more soluble than gypsum, efflorescing, so not really a playa, but springs in this region fed by water that's infiltrating into the adjacent mountains coming up as springs. You lose the shrub community in these areas and have soils that are dominated by grasses, specifically saltgrass Disticulus spicatum. Our prediction with this is if the water tables drop in this region, we could lose quite a bit of the plant cover in this region, which may then help, well, not help, but then could increase the susceptibility of this area to erosion and dust production. As we've heard from our previous talks, dust is an important part of what goes on over geologic time, soil forming time, but it is also impacting a lot of the communities day to day that are living now in these climates. Okay, moving down to Las Vegas, Nevada. We went down here to Las Vegas to help the city of North Las Vegas and the Bureau of Land Management come up with a plan on how to dispose of public lands. There is an act in Congress that allowed the Bureau of Land Management to sell public lands to allow the greater metropolitan area of Las Vegas grow. Classic southern Great Basin, Mojave Desert, geomorphology, vegetation communities. So the ranges, this is the Sheep Range north of Las Vegas, these beautiful, big, broad alluvial fans. The mineralogy of the alluvium being influenced by the rock material and the drainage, and we see often difference in the shrub community based on the mineralogy of the fans. Creosote bush, or Liria tridentata, is the dominant shrub in this area, and then Ambrosia dumosa, and then Yucca shedigera in this particular slide. Areas that the alluvium is dominated by limestone, the soils are very calcareous, carbonatic mineralogy. Ambrosia dumosa, this is a dominant shrub. Calcic horizons, calcium carbonate accumulation, but not cemented, very common. In other areas where we have more mixed mineralogy, where we have gravelly deep soils, creosote bush, the Liria tridentata, is dominant. This soil here has quite a bit of the desert pavement on the surface that Les McFadden, similar to what he was just talking about. These are much older surfaces. They are still gravelly deposits, but they are also, soils are quite a bit more developed, and so in the I'm going to have to switch to this thing. I can't use that. Down here, we have a petrocalcic horizon at about 60 centimeters. So switching back to this last slide, the density of Liria tridentata is usually less where we have the shallow soils in the Mojave Desert, western part of this basin and range province. Areas where on the basin floor where there were spring deposits during the Pleistocene, we find world-class megafaunal fossils, bison, camel, mastodons, horses. It is also the area where we have a high concentration of rare endemic plant species. So one of our plants of interest was Arctomycon californica, or the Las Vegas bear poppy. And what we find over and over in arid areas is that these rare endemic plant species are in areas that have relatively low plant cover, very low in competition compared to some of these other landforms we were talking about. And this particular soil, it's petrocalcicarizing at about 50 centimeters, so hard pan, limiting perhaps the diversity of vegetation that would occupy the site. And also huge amount, we're talking about 60 to 75% of the volume of the soil is consumed by carbonate nodules and concretions. Some of the soils, we find these rare plants had gypsum in them, some didn't, but typically a physical environment, shallow soil, high nodule concretion concentration to limit the competition. And as Las Vegas encroaches here on the edge, these megafaunal fossils in these spring deposits and this plant habitat being a very interesting management situation, managing urbanization as well as preservation of plants and interesting geologic features. Okay, moving down to the area where most of the precipitation or a greater amount of the precipitation comes in, as Craig mentioned, in the summertime versus the wintertime, down near Las Cruces. Classic examples, you've probably read a lot in the literature about on the Jornada Experimental Range and how these warm season grasses, these classic desert grasslands, Bouteloua gracilis, or sorry, black grama, Bouteloua eruditopoda, I'm thinking Colorado Plateau, and how some of these soils have been invaded by woody shrubs, small trees, such as mesquite, Prosopis glandulosa. There could be some resilience of these ecosystems to disturbance based upon some of the soil properties, such as is there an argillic horizon that can help retain water? What is the depth to a cemented calcium carbonate horizon, this petrocalcic horizon? Nearby, and I know Curtis has worked a lot in this area so he could address this, other grasslands, what appear to be of higher density of mesquite, and perhaps there's something to do with depth to the petrocalcic horizon in that the resilience of that ecosystem. Further to the east, on Otera Mesa, we had the opportunity to work on a project looking at collecting the data for digital soil mapping and state and transition models. So in this area, we find creosote bush, Luria tridentata, on much shallower soils than I would expect from what we would see in the Mojave Desert to the west. And so it's interesting, perhaps the precipitation regime in the eastern part of this Chihuahuan Desert Basin and Range, that summer precipitation allowing the creosote bush to survive in this environment. I know Curtis also worked with Mike Dunaway on the ability of these petrocalcic horizons to actually provide some moisture to these shrubs during the dry season. The classic black grama soils in this area, as we would find in the Colorado Plateau, usually quite deep soils without root-restricting layers such as petrocalcic horizons. Okay, moving to now the southern part of the Colorado Plateau. Colorado Plateau, the soils, if we look, you know, broad painted brush, are mainly bedrock controlled, and there are a lot of aeolian deposits on these surfaces, and then we have some smaller areas that are dominated by alluvium and colluvium. These bedrock controlled landscapes, arid climates, we often see trees. Of course, these are going to be on the wetter end of the arid climate. Pinyon juniper community, pinyon pine, like some of that summer moisture, as well as the juniper. that arid climate, this highly dissected landscape on the Moenkopi Formation, we see these trees on shallow, rocky soils, almost counterintuitive if you think about a large tree. We usually think about deeper soils. These junipers will have a very extensive rooting system. They probably get their roots down into cracks, and probably the shale can hold some water as well. Where we have thin aeolian deposits in this Circle Cliffs area of the Colorado Plateau, we lose, believe it or not, the deeper soils, we lose the tree vegetation, and we have a shrub and grass dominated ecosystem instead. Areas where we were thinking maybe we didn't even have to dig because there were no soils there, we really found on these poorly vegetated slopes some of the most developed soils in the Circle Cliffs, because the material, in this case the Chinle Formation, was non-lithified. The high clay content and the sodium content, high pH of these soils, likely limiting the community of plants that can thrive, and grow to reproductive maturity. Okay, moving farther to the north to the Colorado Plateau, I want to tell you about the Beef Basin sagebrush versus grass controversy. So Beef Basin is where the Dugout Ranch, which is now owned by the Nature Conservancy, grazes their one of the large sections of their cattle herd. It's an area that the livestock grazers say should be a grassland, and then you talk to the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, and they say, no, this should all be sagebrush, as evidenced by this exclosure where the cattle cannot get into is dominated by sagebrush. So there was a group of people from Utah State University and the Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service, the Nature Conservancy, USGS, and Division of Wildlife to try to plan what do we do in this area. Those who want to preserve deer and elk hunting in the wintertime say this should be sagebrush, and there are people like me that look at these soils and say these are grassland soils. A lot of these grassland areas, typically the grasses are on the deepest soils, especially if they are on the sandy range. But you can see in the background here that there are some sagebrush carcasses, and those sagebrush that are now dead are on soils that typically look like a grassland soils. So perhaps on the margins where there was sagebrush, there was seed dispersal, plant establishment in a wet enough climate for those plants to grow to reproductive maturity, and then as the climate shifted with the variations, the plants were dead. As we increasingly went to areas that have still live sagebrush, the soils typically have calcic or argillic horizons in the lower part. And that's more typically what we see in the Colorado Plateau in this region. The deep soils, especially if they're sandy, dominated by grasses, the shallower soils that also can have developed horizons like calcic horizons, argillic horizons, or over hard rock supporting that shrub community. So we're still working now with the BLM. The BLM wants to do massive restoration for sagebrush in this area, and there's some of us that are saying, wait, we need more data to figure out what's going on. Okay, the last thing I want to talk about are rare endemic plants. There's a relatively high number of endemic plants in Colorado Plateau. So the three I'm going to talk about are Jones cycladinia, shrubby reed mustard, and the Uinta Basin hookless cactus. All of these soils occur on shallow soils, lithogustic toriorthents. So first in Castle Valley near Moab, these soils are typically something that would be mapped as badland. And the Jones cycladinia was determined by some people in the past that it was a gypsophile, required gypsum. Our work showed that gypsum are in some soils, others not. again, this theme coming back that these rare endemic plants are in areas of low plant competition. Shallow soils, high rock fragment content, and very little competition from your major plant species. Moving to the Uinta Basin in the northern part of the Colorado Plateau, Shoenda crombie supertussens, or shrubby reed mustard, occurs specifically in the Green River Formation in this typically white-colored soil. There are three major populations that the Bureau of Land Management had us work on. In all populations, the soils are shallow, usually 35 centimeters or less. The soils have a very white color. Analysis indicates that these soils have greater than 50% calcium carbonate. The pH is 8.5 or greater. Smectite-dominated clay and silt mineralogy. That material is very spectrally distinct, and so we were able to develop a predictive model based on spectral data primarily to map the location of potential habitat in this region. This region is under a lot of pressure for fossil fuel extraction, as is on the other side to the east, other side of the Green River, south of Vernal. Here we have natural gas extraction. And you can see the scale of the bar in the lower left is about 3,300 feet. So this landscape has been altered by the development of a road network and well pads where they're extracting natural gas. A threatened plant, Sclerocactus wetlandicus, beautiful plant, very different kind of strategy. This plant actually is in an area that there's nothing special about it. It seems not to be restricted to a particular plant type, but it's rare. Soils are all shallow, however, which is part of this theme, shallow, fairly high rock fragment content. We also determined that this soil, plant was associated with a arbuscular mycorrhizal fungus, which is possibly helpful if we're looking at revegetating communities. We also examined the well pad. This well pad had been reclaimed for about 20 years, and still it has no vegetation on it. The soils have little to no vegetation, which meant the vegetation communities differed very much from our sites that had and did not have the plant. In the well pad soils, the electrical conductivity was much higher, commonly over 30 decisiemens per meter. We had some sites that were over 100 decisiemens per meter when the natural soils, undisturbed soils, I should say, had all less than 1 decisiemens per meter electroconductivity. Much higher sodium, and we see a lot of artifacts like pieces of plastic buckets and geofabric. Anyway, as we have climate change in the southwest, predicted to be warmer and drier throughout the region, in the Great Basin, this means less precipitation as snow, more as rain. In the Colorado Plateau, particularly, shorter summer precipitation events, which are going to be interesting in terms of adjusting that competition between the plants. As we've heard before, the dendrochronology and sediment records illustrate there's been this climate change and that there's plant and therefore the landscape responses to that climate change. So if the climate gets drier, plant cover decreases, that's when we have the big sediment, the erosional events that contribute to the sediments. We put over this land use and the changing climate, we still want to preserve historical land uses like livestock grazing, so it's very important we work on state and transition models. Urbanization is growing. Phoenix is growing. Las Vegas is growing. Read the water knife. Irreversible loss of plant and pollinator habitat. And then the non-renewable energy extraction, oil and gas, is irreversibly changing the nature of this landscape and of the soil physical and chemical properties, resulting in irreversible fragmentation and loss of habitat. And I also wanted to mention there are challenges also with renewable energy production. My mom has lived in Lake Havasu City, about 3.5 hours to the west, for a long time. And just south of Las Vegas, I drive this all the time. The scale of this photograph is about the same as the scale of the Uinta Basin I just showed you. And there's plans for expansion, further expansion of the solar panels that are just south of Las Vegas. So give you something to think about in the future. Plant communities, human impacts, climate change, and what are the management implications? It's really a fascinating area for us to get into. Thanks.